All right. Our last case for this week and our second one today is number 22-10811, ECB USA Incorporated et al. Versus Chubb Insurance Company of New Jersey et al. Mr. Marco, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court. My name is David Marco. I'm here with my colleague Joel Magolnik on behalf of the appellants, ECB USA and Atlantic Ventures. Your honors, my clients stand in the shoes of Constantin and Associates, a New Jersey accounting firm that was insured on a New Jersey insurance policy with the appellants. Your honors, this case boils down to the meaning of one sentence in the policy, which defined one of the three coverages. The three coverages were computer consulting, temp placement services, and finally, a defined term, management consulting services. Management consulting services was a defined term that had an arbitrary meaning, which was found in the policy, which was as follows. It said, meaning, services directed towards an expertise in banking, finance, comma, accounting, comma, risk and systems analysis, design and implementation, comma, and asset recovery and strategy planning for financial institutions. Unfortunately, the court ruled in summary judgment that for financial institutions modifies each and every one of those services under the definition of management consulting services, and we respectfully believe that that was error. Premise one, New Jersey law governs. It was argued multiple times by us below. It was never ruled on the court until the court entered summary judgment.
What do you mean? That I don't understand what you're saying.
We asked that New Jersey law apply to the contract.
The district court applied. You may think it applied it incorrectly, but it applied it.
We think it was correct. The court did, in fact, declare that New Jersey law governs the contract. Premise two.
I thought that wasn't disputed here.
The other side didn't really take a position, but it's the premise behind my argument, Your Honor, is because New Jersey law governs. Premise two is New Jersey law states that when there is a modifier at the end of a series, that modifier only applies to the last item in the series unless it is separated by a comma or unless it is otherwise apparent on the face of the line of the series itself. And we respectfully—
Does it really say that? Does it say, unless it's separated by a comma?
Unless it's separated by a comma.
All right, what case says that?
No. CRT versus MT. Urango versus Urango applies the last antecedent.
Yeah, I mean, I'm familiar with the last antecedent canon, I guess. I understood that canon to be— I understood your argument about the separated by a comma to be more about the series qualifier canon. I thought you were arguing that the series qualifier canon doesn't apply unless there's a comma.
Both, Your Honor, because the series qualifier canon is a larger set.
Right.
So the series qualifier canon could be a prepositive or a last antecedent issue. It could be a modifier at the beginning of a series or it could be a modifier at the end of a series. What the New Jersey, 18 out of 18 New Jersey court cases say, is that if there is a modifier at the end of the series, that unless it is separated from the series, it applies to the last item on the list. And that
unless, unless there are reasons to think otherwise.
Unless it was apparent otherwise.
This case involves, as you say, New Jersey law.
Correct.
If I can't figure out which side has the better argument of New Jersey law, because it seems to me that everything is at equipoise, why would I reverse?
Because Princeton versus Investment Partners, a New Jersey case says that if both sides have a reasonable interpretation of that phrase, Your Honor, then you would decide in favor of coverage, right? Because they are, it is a contract of adhesion. It's between two unequal partners in that contract. So the insured always should prevail unless it is some odd circumstance where it was a reinsurance contract between two mega insurance companies where they artisanally negotiated some sort of contract between themselves. But there is a line of cases in New Jersey that is probably universal to the 50 states, although I don't know for sure, that says when there is a dispute between two insured and an insurer, you interpret in favor of coverage unless the parties are equal. And in this case, the parties are not equal.
How are they not? So let me ask you this. I thought that the contra preferendum canon is really about contracts of adhesion, where you've got, you know, the insurer that writes the contract and then the insured, you know, someone like me that's getting property insurance or car insurance or something, you just have to accept the contract as it is. Is that this case, or wasn't this a negotiated contract between two sophisticated parties?
Not a negotiated contract, not between two sophisticated partners. An example of what you're talking about, Your Honor, is Chubb Cargo versus Prudential. It was a reinsurance contract in the New Jersey case that was cited by the other side, and the court said—
That was two insurance companies against each other.
They said they're not equal. I mean, they're equals.
Right, but I mean, why isn't this like that? I mean, wasn't this like a tailor-made contract for providing insurance against these specific services that your client provided?
No, Your Honor. So my client doesn't exist until 2015-16 when it applies for insurance. And when it completes its application, this is the process, and it's in the record. They submit an application. They identified their three services that they were providing inside them and their group: accounting, IT management, and consulting. They identified the customers that their lead customers: BMW, an auto company, not a financial institution, multiple other parties inside that application, and nothing in that application provides any artisanal requests or language or specific anything. It says, we're an accounting firm, this is what we do. And a policy was issued on the basis of that. There is no evidence in the record that there was a negotiation, and in fact, it is very much like a consumer. You go to your broker and you submit your application, it's sent to the insurance company, and they issue a policy on the basis of it, and you pay your premium. So it is exactly like the sort of adhesive contracts where you request a policy and a policy is issued to you. And in this particular instance, the case law in New Jersey is crystal clear. So the case that I cite for you is actually very similar to our case, Princeton Investment Partners. These are not just average small consumers. This is a small accounting firm which requested a professional lines insurance policy for the services that it provided. There was nothing in that application in 2016, which was renewed in 2017. I'll go a step further, Your Honor. The policy in 2017-18, which is the period of time where the claim is made, it wasn't even the same insurance company anymore. It had changed from ERI, Chubb, to Chubb of New Jersey. So it wasn't even the same insurance company. They just reissued the policy on the same application from the immediately preceding year with no reference whatsoever to financial industry, financial institutions, nothing that would lead to that modification. So where we are is back to the concept of construction. If four financial institutions is not separated by a comma, then the rule of the last antecedent and the series qualifier canon, the umbrella concept, says that that only applies to the last item in the list.
Let me ask you this, though. It's one of the odd things about this language from the last antecedent series qualifier is you concede that four financial institutions applies to asset recovery, right? So it's asset recovery and strategy planning for financial institutions. How does that concession, which I think just makes sense on the face of reading the document, how does that concession consistent with applying the last antecedent canon?
So, Your Honor, simply because if you can do asset recovery for something other than a financial institution, first of all, but more importantly, it is tied to it only reinforces the point, because you can provide accounting for a pizza parlor or a financial.
No, I understand your point, but I guess if we're following the last antecedent canon and that's what we have to follow, then why wouldn't four financial institutions just modify strategy planning because that's the last antecedent? Asset recovery isn't the last antecedent.
So it could, but Facebook tells you why not. So Justice Sotomayor says there is, and I'll try to remember, it was store and produce, comma, using randomizing or sequencing technology. It's a TCPA case. And she states for the court that because that phrase, store and produce, is not separated from each other by a comma, it is called an integral phrase. It is treated as one.
I mean, but all of this stuff, I mean, at some point, it just becomes mind-numbing.
Agreed.
All these rules of interpretation and canons and commas and semicolons and labels, it's just all, at some point it becomes undecipherable.
Not everywhere.
Almost everywhere. I mean,
in New Jersey.
Carl Llewellyn.
New Jersey.
Carl Llewellyn wrote a famous law review article in 1950 in the Vanderbilt Law Review, which for the first time codified and told the world, even though people knew about it beforehand, that for every canon, there's an opposing canon. And that decision makers have to choose most of the time when there are opposing canons about which one fits better in a certain circumstance. And that's why the recent Supreme Court cases, for example, Judge Alito's comments indicate that canons are just aids. You don't follow them, you know, religiously and blindly because they don't always give you an answer.
May I answer, Your Honor?
Of course you can, but here's the comment I want you to tie into your answer.
Yes, sir.
Judge Scola thought, and you can tell me why it's wrong, irrelevant, or whatever. Judge Scola thought that it mattered on the motion for reconsideration that on the application, control group stated that coverage was desired for, quote, management consulting for the financial community, end quote. And that sort of gave an indication of how you should read the clause. That if it was for the financial community, it made sense that the four financial institutions language modified the entire series. So you can answer the initial question and comment on that too.
In reverse order, as my teenager would say, gotcha. Because in order for you to engage in that analysis, you would have had already concluded that it's vague. To look back in the policy history, you would have already said, what was this really about? And if that's true, Princeton Investment Partners says that that struggle is favored by the insured, not the insurer. And second of all, very importantly, Constantin and Associates, the accounting firm, did not exist in that application in 2003. They filed their own application in 2015, and that application had nothing to do with any language such as that. And that was renewed and renewed. And more to the point, which I mentioned at the beginning of my argument, it wasn't even the same insurer at the time that we're making our claim.
On the last point, whoever becomes an additional insured necessarily buys into whatever the coverage is.
They were not an additional insured. They were the applicant. They were.
No. One of them was an additional insured.
2015.
Right.
In 2016, and no application ever said that again. No application ever said that again.
Right. That's why Judge Scola thought that the policy should be reformed, reread, et cetera, to have them as somebody who was covered. Right?
Right. Your Honor, he did that by looking back into the content of the policy. He wouldn't do that if he didn't already conclude it was vague. If it is vague, there's an automatic off-ramp. You have an insured. And to hold a company that didn't even exist at the time to that, we think, is a bridge too far. But more importantly, it means that we are now interpreting the contract. One last point, Your Honor. In Cassidy, the court in New Jersey court in Cassidy states that you don't even look back at the history. It's not like Judge Leventhal looking in a crowd for a friendly face. It's a situation where you look to the expectations of the applicant, and Constantin's expectations were clear. It's not the expectations of the parties. It's not the intent of the parties. It's the expectation of the insured. And the expectation of Constantin and Associates, we do accounting, period. We do IT management, period. We do consulting, and we do it for non-financial institutions, the largest customer they had, BMW, an automaker. And that was on their application. They sent a clear message to that insurance company. And of course the insurance company did or didn't modify its language as it chooses to. It's a contract of adhesion. They don't negotiate that language with you. They issue a policy to you. And because of the rule of the last antecedent, it isn't ambiguous. Because four financial institutions only modifies the last phrase in that series. So of course there'd be nothing to consider or change. And to cut the cake against the insured in this context, where there's nothing that indicates that it is a negotiated contract, as Judge Brasher correctly asks, that it was artisanal, that there was anything going on other than, hey, here's my application, this is what I do, non-financial institutions, and we're an accounting firm. It's a professional accounting firm. They take any client. And the insurance company knew that, and the insurance company issued a policy on it, and they were not there when they needed them most.
So the district court relied on the wrong extrinsic evidence in terms of determining the party's intent.
An asteroid in outer space as it related to Constantin and Associates. Their intent is what mattered. And they were the applicant on the 2016 policy, the first named insured.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Sasso.
May it please the court. My name is Gary Sasso, and I represent Chubb Insurance Company. As we've discussed, the policy of this case limits coverage to management consulting services, defined as services directed toward expertise in banking, finance, accounting, risk and systems analysis, design and implementation, asset recovery, and strategy planning for financial institutions. The loss in this case arose from an audit for a food company, not a financial institution. Based on the plain language of that provision, we move for summary judgment. Just months before motions were due, the Supreme Court decided Facebook, which held, under conventional rules of grammar, when there is a straightforward parallel construction that involves all nouns or verbs in a series, a modifier at the end of the list normally applies to the entire series, which generally reflects the most natural reading of a sentence. Quoting Scalia and Garner, a treatise on literary style and grammar.
Canons. That was the potential limitation of that case, is that it's not applying New Jersey rules of construction.
Correct.
And theoretically, at least, if New Jersey has a different view of how you interpret this sort of stuff, we have to apply New Jersey's rules and not the Supreme Court's federal common law rule.
I understand the qualification, Your Honor, but the chronology is very important. And when that argument was made and how it was made is very important. At this stage of summary judgment, we're basically talking about literary style or grammar, not legal canons of construction, literary style and grammar, quoting Scalia and Garner. ECB had very
little. I
understand
what you mean. Of course,
Brian Garner.
I know who Mr. Garner is. Everybody's using canons of construction
right,
here.
Exactly, Your Honor.
At summary judgment.
Exactly, Your Honor. That's where we were. And ECB had very little to say about this on summary judgment. They said, well, in Facebook, there was a comma, and the court mentioned that, and there's no comma here, so that makes a difference. It's true, but the court and Facebook did not rely on that. It relied instead on the fact that the modifying clause appears after an integrated list. We also cited United States versus Bass, another United States Supreme Court case, and the trial court did too. And ECB said, well, Bass says, where there is no comma, there's an ambiguity, and therefore, in our case, the clause has to be construed in favor of the insurer. Well, Bass had nothing to say about that. Bass was a criminal case that dealt with firearms, and it was an extensive discussion of legislative construction and tough policy issues. And the government argued in that case, there's no comma, so the serial modifier must be applied to the immediately preceding noun. Justice Marshall, writing an opinion for the court, echoed Judge Jordan's views, dismissed that argument in a footnote, footnote 6, saying, well, grammarians are divided on this. And where grammarians are divided, let alone cheerfully tolerant, we will not attach significance to an omitted comma. That's what Bass did. So based on these cases and the literary and grammarian concerns, the trial court entered summary judgment for us. That was it. That was all the discussion about it at summary judgment. Then ECB moved for reconsideration. And for the first time, ECB argued, well, there are a string of New Jersey cases that treat this as a matter of law, not a canon of construction, not literary grammarial choice. This is a canon of law. It's mandated under New Jersey law that if you don't have a comma, the series qualifier can apply only to the immediately preceding noun. It's mandated. The judge said, where was this argument on summary judgment? You didn't argue that this was a matter of a legal requirement, let alone a mandate. You didn't argue that this was mandated by New Jersey law. You didn't cite these New Jersey cases to us. This has been waived. And the trial court was correct under a number of authorities we discussed in our briefs, including Sun Life Assurance, which says a party waives its opportunity to rely on non-forum law where it fails to timely provide the sources of non-forum law on which it seeks to rely.
I just don't get the waiver argument, and I really don't. I get this, you're trying to draw a line, I guess, between just relying on Scalia and Garner versus relying on, like, some element of New Jersey law. But, I mean, they argued for the statutory, they argued for the interpretation at the district court that they are arguing for now, right?
But they didn't argue it as a legal requirement. They were fussing over grammar and literary style. They didn't present to the trial court. They sandbagged the trial court.
To not waive the argument, they had to cite the specific cases that they're citing on appeal? It seems odd.
They had to argue that this was required as a matter of law, as a matter of New Jersey law, and they didn't. They were arguing over the interpretation of Facebook. So that's where the case stood at that time. Then they moved for reconsideration and said, we've got all this, and the court said it's waived.
Now they've taken an appeal. The cases are all over, in my opinion, are all over the place on whether or not asserting a theory without all the particulars is enough, or whether sort of shifting within the theory on appeal for the first time is a problem. And you can find cases going both ways on that, especially in our court. You've got Sun Life on the one hand. You have a case that Judge Newsom wrote relatively recently on the other. And you can find strands to support both arguments. The question is, in this case, since everybody agreed that New Jersey law applied, right, why was it wrong for them to do it the way they did it?
Because, Your Honor, they raised it on a motion for reconsideration. The judge made that finding of waiver in his order on reconsideration, and they don't challenge that on appeal.
Well, he said, I'm not going to reconsider
that order of waiver.
I think it's perfectly reasonable for a district court to say, look, I'm not going to reconsider my decision. You know, that's fine. But that doesn't tell us how we should review the district court's decision, right?
The question is
whether they waived it for purposes of appeal, not whether the district court was right in saying, I'm not going to reconsider because you didn't cite this before.
Well, correct, Your Honor. An order on reconsideration is subject to review for abuse of discretion. Now, the court went on and addressed and rejected their argument on the merits on this issue, too, and I'm going to get to that. But the waiver argument is important because here's what they did. They then appealed to this court. In their notice of appeal, they appealed from the order on summary judgment, the order on reconsideration, and the final judgment. And under Rule 34 of the Rules of Appellate Procedure, all of these are merged. But in their initial brief in this court, they mention nothing about reconsideration. They don't talk about the arguments presented. They don't talk about the rulings made by the trial court, which is utterly unfair to this court to take a matter up from the trial court to this court and not inform this court about the subsequent litigation, proceedings, and dispositions by the trial court, asking this court to reach down and review only the order on summary judgment under de novo standard and ignore everything the trial court did on reconsideration, including this finding of waiver. Now, when we called them on that in our response brief, here's what they said in their reply brief. They said, ECB appeals summary judgment as set forth in the district court's amended omnibus order, and nothing more. Nevertheless, Chubb spends most of its brief ignoring the amended order and arguing the district court's denial of ECB's motion for reconsideration, which is not on appeal. So they're not appealing. They've abandoned an appeal of the judge's determination of waiver. They've abandoned an appeal on the judge's determination on the merits against them on reconsideration. They've abandoned it. That is a waiver. That's a pretty stark waiver under any case, under any holding, including this court's decision in Sapupo, which says when an appellant fails to challenge properly on appeal one of the grounds on which the district court based its judgment, he's deemed to have abandoned any challenge of that ground, and it follows that the judgment is due to be affirmed. To accept this procedure would be to do a terrific disservice to the trial courts and this court.
Let's say that
turning to the merits. Yes, yes.
To the merits. Okay. Yes. So let's say that the contract provision is ambiguous. And in that case, it is appropriate for a court to look at extrinsic evidence, which focuses on the party's intent. In this case, as counsel stated or argued, it's Constantine is the relevant party here. Why is it not, why wasn't it improper for the district court to look at another party's intent at the time the initial contract was made, as opposed to the intent of the party at issue here?
All of these insureds were affiliated. They were related. In fact, there was a dispute whether Constantine should even be a party, and they were all affiliated and related. And from 2001 through 2017, new coverage wasn't written. It was simply a renewal of the original policy in 2001, which is why it was appropriate to go back to the application in 2001. Now, let's address the merits and consider what the trial court said and did. The trial court said, you're wrong about these New Jersey cases. As Judge Brasher was saying, they didn't say that this doctrine is mandated in all cases. They say over and over, unless the contrary intention otherwise appears. And the trial court said, contrary intention otherwise appears on the face of this language. Under the plain language, there's no other reasonable way to interpret this than to say, for financial institutions applies to all of the services listed. It would be absurd.
Let me tell you a potential problem for me conceptually.
Yes.
And I don't know which way it cuts, but if you say that this clause, if New Jersey law says that this sort of a thing has to be normally read to modify every item in a series, right? Unless there's a contrary intention, and they've already told you what the general reading of that provision is, how can you draw any contrary intention from the same language? Like, if the language gives you a default position, how can that language ever give you a contrary indication? The same language give
that's
you
a default rule.
Contrary indication.
It depends on what's said in the series and how it's said. All these cases are different. Most of the cases they cite are legislative interpretation cases. And Kamiansky, one of those cases, Superior Court of New Jersey, said, punctuation, though important, is not decisive of legislative intent. They say they have two contract cases. It's really only one. One is an injunction case. The other is a contract case, Yolango. Had nothing to do with commas. There were four enumerated provisions, and the court said the fourth, as a matter of substance, seems to apply to the third. So what these courts do in New Jersey is they look at the language.
Yeah.
They comb the legislative history for legislation.
On that point, in follow-up to Judge Jordan's question, I think your weakest, to me, the weakest part of your argument is, under your argument, we would read it to say expertise in banking finance for financial institutions, right? Because we would apply the four financial institutions to everything. Accounting for financial institutions, I understand that would make sense. Risk and systems analysis for financial institutions makes sense. What does banking finance for financial institutions mean? Wouldn't that just make it redundant?
No, it's not. And the trial court explicitly addressed that issue and said management consulting is provided to banking finance on banking finance issues for financial institutions.
So what does that mean, though?
Financial institutions have to get banking, and they get debt. And all kinds of financial institutions get loans and debt and so on, and they need management consulting on how to go about that. And it's not at all redundant. All of these services are services provided for financial institutions. Now, ECB hangs a lot of weight on a supposed ambiguity in this language. The trial court didn't find any. He said it would be absurd to read the clause the way they do, applying this limitation for financial institutions only to the last listed service. So there's no basis for that. The plain language dictates they apply to all of them. So there is no ambiguity. But as the court was discussing with counsel, the New Jersey Supreme Court has rejected their approach to ambiguity in construing contracts in favor of the insured in Chubb versus Prudential. As the court implied, we do have sophisticated parties here on both sides of this deal.
Yeah, so they say that they aren't a sophisticated party. Are they wrong about that?
Well, they are absolutely wrong about it. The insured was Constantine Control Group. It's an international conglomerate that provides sophisticated management consulting to financial institutions. They certainly knew how to ask for broader coverage if that's what they wanted. Further, under New Jersey law, you have to have an ambiguity that's much more consequential than this, even to get in that issue. In Hobbs, as one example, District of New Jersey said, an insurance policy is not ambiguous merely because two conflicting interpretations have been offered by the litigants. A genuine ambiguity exists when the phrasing of the policy is so confusing that the average policyholder cannot make out the boundaries of the coverage. Trial court said it's just exactly the opposite here. You'd have to be on drugs not to understand this plain language. It's not at all confusing to the insured, especially this insured. Opposing counsel embraces the Cassidy decision, so do we. And the trial court in this case followed that roadmap in Cassidy, District of New Jersey case, in interpreting this contract. That case involved interpretation of a coverage provision on summary judgment. The court said it can be done by the court. Our job is to ascertain the intent of the parties primarily from the contract, but also attend its circumstances, the objects the parties are striving to attain. We may look at extrinsic evidence, citing Chubb versus Prudential, including the policy. And they looked at the policy there, and on that basis, in that case, said there's no coverage. Here, the 2001 policy asked Constantine, what do you want covered? What kind of professional liability? They wrote management consulting for the financial community.
But that I understood Constantine was written, to be arguing that at their intent as expressed didn't limit them to those financial servicing institutions.
That's what
that's
they
why
said they
I
wanted.
Asked my earlier question, which I thought was a little cursory in terms of your response.
Yeah, they say, Mr. Marco says that the district court was looking at the wrong thing and that, and hold on.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm trying to paraphrase Mr. Marco's argument without commenting on whether it's right or wrong or not. I'm just giving it to you so you can respond. That when Constantine submitted its application, it, for example, listed BMW as a client, and BMW, despite its financial, girth, is not a financial institution.
That argument was never made below. This is the first time we've heard that argument. What the trial court looked at was what was presented below. And what was presented below was the application that was filed by Constantine in 2001, where they said, we want coverage for management consulting for the financial community. The coverage was written in 2001. Every year thereafter, it was renewed. It wasn't a newly issued policy, it was renewed. And the coverage language was never changed. All that Constantine added in the record in this case was in 2016-17, they added accounting services. They never added food companies among the services.
Where does the language that Mr. Marco is referring to come from? I know you say it wasn't presented, but where does it come from?
You'd have to ask Mr. Marco, Your Honor.
It's not in the record?
We're not aware of it. The argument was not made below. This argument was not made to the trial court below.
Okay, Mr. Sasso, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Marco, he says that you didn't make this argument below about what the relevant Constantine application said or listed.
We argue it in the appeal. They're the ones.
He says it was not in the record below and that the argument was not made below.
Your Honor,
whatever the effect of that, respond, please.
Yes, sir. Every application that was provided to us is in the record in this case. They are part of the record that was in the summary judgment record. I can have it supplementally identify exactly.
No, if you say it's in the record, that's good enough and we'll find it.
100%. Not every application was produced, but every application that they provided to us in discovery was part of the record on summary judgment. Very importantly, my esteemed colleague says Constantin put financial institutions or financial industry in an application. This never happened because Constantin and Associates didn't even exist in 2001. It didn't exist for another 10 years.
That was control group, for lack of a better term, that
correct.
Put that in there.
Constantin and Associates first appears in 2015-16 as the first named insured. 2016, first named insured. 2017, renewal policy that we're operating under. So you will not see anything in the record where there is Constantin and Associates as an applicant in a policy prior to its very corporate existence.
I'm not sure that matters, I guess. It's hard for me to understand because I think the point of looking at the application is to understand why the document was written the way it was, right? And since the document didn't change, what does it matter that the insurance was taken over by somebody else?
Because if you follow, so I actually want to walk one concept back if I can. Princeton Investment Partners is the governing law of New Jersey, which is that if there's an ambiguity, it inures in favor of coverage. What I was explaining was that if you follow the trail of the case that they cite in Cassidy, it's not the intent of the parties, it was the expectations of the applicant. And the expectations of the applicant is, as Judge Jordan rhetorically asked, maybe for or against us, I do not know, that, wait a second, BMW is on that application in 2016. Right? They're not a financial institution. And so what was the expectation of the insured? It doesn't go into an examination of the historical record of a policy. That's not what it calls for. Second of all, it cites to Chubb versus Prudential, which was an artisanally negotiated policy between two aircraft carrier groups. That is not at all what's going on here. Third, it's kind of funny to explain us as an international conglomerate. We're a New Jersey accounting firm that identified how much money we made a year on those applications, less than $5 million a year. We're not an international conglomerate. We were a New Jersey applicant that makes a few million dollars a year. I don't want to say exactly how much, but it's quite small. It's below $5 million, I know that. There is no kind of sophisticated negotiation of superpowers. So respectfully, Your Honors, you wouldn't ever even look at the policy. You would say, could this language on its face appears, could accounting be provided to something other than a financial institution? Yes. And because it could, it's a reasonable reading. So the analysis really stops at, is the reading on its face a reasonable reading in our favor?
But there are some New Jersey cases, and I'm by no means an expert on any law, much less New Jersey law. There are some New Jersey cases that say just because you have reasonable interpretations on two sides of a question does not necessarily lead to a legal ambiguity, right? And so the question is, how do you parse those cases, and when is it that different valid interpretations lead to ambiguity, and when don't they?
Here's what I would
say.
That's
hard.
Yeah. So my answer to you is you really only ask one question. Is our interpretation a reasonable one? Because if our interpretation at the face of the language is a reasonable one, the analysis stops there. It doesn't matter whether the other one is reasonable or not. If ours is, by definition, you would inure in favor of coverage because the worst case scenario is it has some ambiguity to it. It's not crystal clear. And if it's not crystal clear, if you can say the following answer to the question, there is nothing inextricably linked to the concept of accounting that must belong to four financial institutions on the face of that language, then you're saying to yourself, it could go either way. You could argue it either way.
Let me ask you to address one thing that you haven't had a chance to address yet. So I think the district court made this point, and they make this point. You know, we're looking at the definition of management consulting services. If accounting means just accounting for anybody, aren't we expanding the defined term is management consulting services. wouldn't accounting sort of swallow up everything going beyond that term? Does that question make sense?
Your question makes sense,
yeah.
And here's
what's your response to it. Yeah.
So management consulting is not a vernacular term, and I think that's something that the judge sort of at the end of his order where the judge sort of, I think, gets a little, I don't want to say confused, what's the word I want? It gets a little fuzzy. I'll say the other side gets a little confused, is that it's not a vernacular concept. Management consulting is not a thing. It doesn't have any sort of meaning on its own. It could say ABC means. It is a defined term, and because it is a defined term, it is a list of 6, 7, 8, I don't remember, specific services that fall within the definition of ABC, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't have any independent meaning at all. It can't be read into. It can't be said, well, that wouldn't make any sense because a management consultant wouldn't do this. It has no independent structure to it at all. It's a defined term, and because it's a defined term, we should follow what it says. And then there's one last thing, if I can, Your Honor. When the reference was made that the court held in U.S. v. Bass and Facebook that the comma was irrelevant, it's very important to remember that Justice Marshall in Bass says what we have is an ambiguous statute. And that's why they went to the rule of lenity. They would never have gone to the rule of lenity unless it was vague. Second point, in Facebook, Justice Sotomayor says that because there's no comma between the two modifying phrases that immediately precede, the last antecedent was two terms, they were, I said them before and I'm so sorry, store and produce in the TCP case, there was no commas between them. So she said it's an integrated phrase. And because it's an integrated phrase, it's one. And that's a total distinction. And yes, there was a comma before the modifier to which it applied to. And that's why it wasn't controversial for us, because it was separated by a comma. The TCPA has the modifying phrase, which is following stores and produce, which is the phrase using a random or sequential number generator modifies that integrated, not separated, store and produce. It is one concept. That is absolutely good law and a basis for you to say that because ours has a bunch of commas in between, doesn't follow. Sorry, Your Honors, I went way over.
No, that's quite all right. Anything else? No. Okay, Mr. Marco, Mr. Sasso, thank you both very, very much. And that concludes.